and a whole bunch of confirmation hearings down also. We saw RFK Jr. fight it out with members of the Senate. We saw Tulsi Gabbard fight it out with members of the Senate. We also saw Kash Patel fight it out with members of the Senate. And they did much of the same as they did the week prior to people like Pete Hegseth. Trying to, especially the blue side of the committees, just try to play games of gotcha. It seems to be a pattern. And I don't really know what the real game is. You know, maybe I'm not that smart. But at the end of the day, it's my opinion that all these confirmation hearings and the questions that are being asked are really to get an understanding of how these people are going to better further the lives of American citizens, of Americans. And it seemed, I didn't watch all of them. It's hours and hours on end to watch all of it. But it seems like a lot of wasted time for things, some things that weren't relevant or things that were way in the past and maybe didn't really matter to the position in question. Of course, people do all kinds of other things before they end up in the job that they're currently interviewing for. And of course, being on the president's cabinet is probably more serious than a whole lot of other jobs any of us have ever interviewed for. But I don't know. The games of gotcha just got old. The one confirmation hearing I think that we are going to examine a little bit further today was that of Mr. Daniel Driscoll. Mr. Daniel Driscoll is a 39-ish year old guy who served a few years in the United States Army, who was Trump's nominee to be the new Secretary of the Army. And I did watch most of his confirmation hearing, and I got to say, he's a pretty impressive guy for the most part. The one thing I did appreciate about him is he didn't seem to take the bait on a lot of things. He did want to seem to go back when accusatory statements or things of that nature were thrown out in his direction, and he wasn't really given a chance to respond. He did try to take some of his time to go back and address those things, and of course he was cut off. The senators would say things like, well, this is my time now, and so you can respond in writing, feel free. So they weren't really there to have a conversation. But understanding that they only have 5 minutes, and of course they go over when allowed. But they talked about a lot of things. They talked about ammunition stockpiles and equipment and drones and all kinds of stuff, vehicles, all, and you name it. And all of it was pretty good conversation for somebody like me who's interested in those things. But today, let's get through the intro, right? Today we're going to talk about Daniel Driscoll's confirmation hearing and how that went. And we will dissect a little bit of it. I found a really good article about the topic in his hearing that I'd like to discuss. So stick with us. Don't go away. We start now. Hey, everybody, and welcome here to the Richard Leonard Show again, another episode. As always, if you're a returning viewer, thank you. We really appreciate you being here, all of us here. If you're new to the program, thanks for stopping by. We hope you come back. And then, of course, before we get started down the path, which we already did for about 4 minutes in the intro, I know that you won't mind me telling you about how the show is made possible. And, of course, that is Cortez Wealth Management. Get yourselves on over to AmericaFirstRetirementPlan.com. Sign up for the webinars. They happen on Tuesday and Thursday evenings at It's 7 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. And just to be clear, it's not webinars. It is a webinar. You can do one or the other. Tuesday or Thursdays at 7 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. Carlos Cortez and his staff want to help you plan and execute a tax-free retirement plan. So get on over there, get the information, ask the questions, go through, find the documents, do the thing, and check it out. You deserve it. It's for you. They want to help you out. You deserve to be able to do all of this. So, America First Retirement Plan, get on over there and check it out. So, of course, we're going to talk about Daniel Driscoll and his hearing today. And I think that one important thing to point out first, and there's been quite a few picks that President Trump has made for many different positions. And he's picked some very young people. Like Daniel Driscoll, for example, is 39. And I think it's a pretty slick move, right? I think that having younger people in some of these, like, for example, his press secretary, that lady, I watched the media day, the very first press conference, and she kicked their asses. She did an amazing job, much like Kayleigh McEnany used to do. And of course, we'll see. Because I'm sure the pressure is going to mount. Things around the world are going to happen. Things in the country are going to happen. And the media is going to go after her and ask her a bunch of questions. Much like Mr. Ducey did to what's her name? The dummy that Biden had. Jean-Pierre, whatever her first name is. Some days she was up there flopping like a flounder. And it was pretty interesting to watch at times. But Daniel Driscoll's a young dude. Served a few years in the Army. He was an Army Ranger. He deployed to a combat zone. But having young blood in some of these leadership roles, especially in when we're talking about military stuff, I think it's very important. Because the same with Pete Hegseth. These guys have put on the uniform. And here's how I kind of will lay this out for you. The United States Army, for example, when I first got in the very early 2000s, we were wearing BDUs, like the dark OD green, brown, and tan camouflage uniforms. The ones you had to press with starch, make them as tightly ironed and pressed. You make your creases like razor blade edges, shine your boots to look like mirrors. It was a whole different kind of army. And that was what was going on when I went through basic training up until probably my second year in the military. And then we went to the ACU, the Army Combat Uniform. But we also had, for soldiers who were deployed to the Middle East, we had the DCUs, like the desert colored camouflage uniforms. And then it wasn't long after that that we got the current Army uniform. I think they're OCPs, they call them now, whatever that acronym is. And so there's been three or four uniforms that have been fielded in just, 23, 24 years since I joined. And there's a lot that's happened. The longest war in our country's history, seen three or four different Army uniforms. And for some people, that's not significant. But for people that served, that's pretty significant. Because we can talk about equipment, right? Equipment is a huge deal to soldiers. When we went away from BDUs, for example, to the ACUs, and we went from button pockets to Velcro pockets and zippers, well, everyone in the Army hated them. The Velcro's loud. Noise discipline is going to be a thing. The zippers are loud. Noise discipline, again, is going to be a thing. But we figured it out. And then later iterations of the uniform went back to buttons. Soldiers were taking the Velcro off their uniforms and having the sole shops and seamstresses put buttons on. There we go. Now we fixed the noise discipline thing. So soldiers are always being innovative with their equipment to make it better. And so one of the things that Mr. Driscoll talked about when it came to equipment was, you know, we had all this cool equipment. You know, like he talked specifically about the MRAP trucks. These MRAPs were huge, tall, long, super heavy vehicles. Weren't very good for many missions in the Middle East, especially in Afghanistan, where it's mountainous. In Iraq, they became a problem because in the rainy season, when the sand and the dust and the dirt in that desert gets wet, it turns into like concrete and this mud that you can never get off of anything. So these big, super heavy vehicles would get stuck. They're almost impossible sometimes to recover. And so when you're conducting recovery operations outside the wire in a combat zone, these big, huge, heavy vehicles are now something that soldiers don't want to use. Because now it puts our ass in the wind. It makes it difficult for us to do our jobs safely, to go home to our families, and to make sure that the soldier to the left and or right of us also goes home to their families, because we are a team, we fight together. I don't know that very many past secretaries of the Army, I don't know that very many past defense secretaries ever thought about those things. Lloyd Austin wasn't thinking about MRAPs and how shitty they could have been for soldiers. How it would have put their lives at risk and left their ass in the wind. No. These folks are at such high positions that they're worried about their next job, a bonus, maybe their next salary, how they're going to gain more power, or how they're going to change the narrative or the what's goings-ons of the United States military, or in this case, the United States Army, to best fit their needs to gain power, control, popularity, whatever it is. Or maybe they just don't know. They don't know because they didn't live it. Pete Hegseth, Daniel Driscoll, they lived it. And so when we're talking about, well, what's the best thing that we can do for the warfighter? Well, I'll tell you, one of those biggest conversations to have is going to be equipment. So I appreciated that part of the conversation. But the biggest thing that he talked about that I found the most interesting was his take on recruiting. Now, we've had many conversations on this show about the recruiting issue, the problem. And it's been dismal. The recruiting climate of the United States military in the past 4 to 5 years has been dismal. It's at a place where we now have less active duty soldiers than we did for World War II. Less active duty soldiers than we did leading into Vietnam before the draft was issued. And the whole reason why we had to have a draft. We have less now. That's a problem. So I found an article. I also found his testimony that matches up with this article. We'll watch that video. It's about 2 minutes long. We'll watch that in the second half of the show. But I'd like to just go through this article quickly. Because his take on this recruiting thing, I think is something that not a lot of people have talked about. I think that there are a circle of soldiers and maybe even and veterans and just people who are interested in the military in this country that have probably talked about in the not so recent past, in the last few years. I mean, everyone is having discussions about, not everyone, but anybody interested in this is having discussions about our recruiting, the problems. Why is nobody joining? Why are people getting, were people getting kicked out? We all know about the COVID and the vaccine and how they were kicking folks out. Yeah, yeah, we know all that. But there's also a problem with gaining interest, gaining the interest of young people in this country to put on a uniform and defend this country from its enemies, both inside and outside our borders. And there's always, there's a lot of people out there that are saying, you know, well, it's the military is doing the dirty work for the United States government and yada yada. And okay, well, maybe so. Maybe that is part of the deal. But there are millions of Americans that have signed up to serve in our military and that are currently serving in this military because they genuinely love this country. And so if anybody's narrative is that they've been lied to and that they're stupid or they're innocently ignorant about the things that the military is directing its soldiers to do, okay, maybe there's some truth to that. But there are also people that love this country. They love their home and they want to defend their home. And so we can get wrapped around the axle about whether or not the government's right about what they do and what they don't do. And maybe some of those things are undisputable. And if that's the case, then they won't be disputed. But I also think that it's undisputed that there are genuinely people that join the military for straight up love for their home, and they want to defend it. Maybe they bought into this big lie. Okay, maybe so. But who are we to tell them that they're fucking stupid? Believe what you want. So let's go through this here. Here we go. Army Secretary Pick says pay boost isn't enough to fix recruiting woes. This is what caught me, right? This was the headline that caught me because the narrative a lot of times is, well, let's just give them more money. Let's give them a better benefit, which usually equates into something of monetary value or some massive discount or something like that. You know, like the VA home loan is a great, amazing thing. It's a great benefit for veterans. I use it. I've used it a few times. But nowadays, it isn't enough to get people enticed. Young people aren't concerned about buying homes. Not like my generation was or the generation before me. Home ownership isn't at the top of their list for whatever reason. Okay, let's go through this here. So, Army Secretary nominee Daniel Driscoll said he'll push service leaders for more non-monetary incentives to boost service soldier recruiting and retention. He said that he believes better pay and benefits alone won't solve the personnel problems. We have the fewest number of active soldiers that we've had since World War II. Even as conflict is erupting around the world, Driscoll told members of the Senate Armed Services Committee during his confirmation hearing on Thursday, we need to fix that. When's the last time we've heard anybody in any of the halls in Washington, D.C. just say, we need to fix it? You always hear, well, okay, it's a problem, and so we should be doing blah, 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 blah. Sometimes having somebody say, it's broke, we need to fix it, and then just stop, to me is more powerful because it invites conversation. It invites ideas. I believe that when people say, it's broken and we should be doing A, B, C, D, and E, you've already made up your mind. The opportunity for good conversation and compromise, because we both know, we all know that for both sides of the aisle to come together, it's going to take some compromise, even though that some of these issues should be the most nonpartisan issues in the halls of our government, in my opinion. We need to fix it. I actually don't think the answer is throwing more money at the problem. I think it's nice to get things like the GI Bill benefit, but I didn't join for that. I enlisted to serve the country. The comments came just a few weeks after lawmakers approved a major pay boost for junior enlisted troops. Set to go into effect in April, the 10% boost was designed in part to ease the financial pressures of young military families. Financial pressures of young military families and make the service more attractive to potential recruits. Oh, Driscoll, who is 38, spent nearly 4 years in the Army as a Cavalry Scout platoon leader, including a deployment to Iraq in 2009. At the hearing, he described his time in the service as transformational to his life, opening the way for opportunities I could scarcely have imagined when I enlisted. So let's talk about this for a second. The 10% pay increase, I think, is great, is nice. But at the end of the day, a 10% boost is not all that attractive to young men and women in this country who don't have serving in the military as like one of their top two choices of what to do with their life. Not when they can go do just about any other job for the same or similar pay. But I agree with him that it shouldn't be all about the pay. When people join the military, there should be some kind of feeling of a sense of duty, a sense of excitement to be one of the people that puts that name tape that says U.S. Army across your heart. In my opinion, there should be. But I will say this, that for some people, that doesn't happen when they enlist. For some people, it happens after they enlist. That's what happened to me. I joined the military because, number one, I wanted to finish college. I was effing around in school. I really enjoyed my college experience. I took advantage of everything college had to offer to me. The only thing that I forgot to do was go to class. So it didn't last long for me. I didn't apply myself. And so when I found myself in a situation where I was on academic suspension from the school I was going to, and I was working these, you know, like low level jobs. I was working at car dealerships and detail shops, cleaning cars and, being a gopher at a car dealership, which I liked those jobs. I had fun. I met some cool people and made some good friends. But I wasn't going anywhere. I wasn't really setting myself up for future success. I was just being. And then my father took my car from me. And it's interesting. It's an interesting conversation. If you're interested and you go over to YouTube and go to Three Clicks Media, I interviewed my father. I interviewed my father not long ago. And we talked about this particular instance when he took my car from me because I failed to pay the car insurance, which is what I agreed to do. Well, and then I found myself in a real tough spot. I couldn't go to work. I didn't have any transportation. And I was living in a spot where none of my people were around me. I was about 35 minutes away from any of my friends. And so I was kind of stuck. And the family that was allowing me to hide out in their basement, the guy was in the Air Force. He was in the Air Force Reserve or the Air Guard. And finally, one day, he told me, he's like, look, you haven't left the basement in like 4 days other than to eat and shower and use the bathroom. What are you going to do? Well, I suppose I'll go talk to a recruiter. And so in a week and a half's time, I was in a recruiting office, you know, I was at MEPS, raising my right hand, taking the oath of enlistment, and enlisting in the Minnesota Army National Guard. And just like that, I was a member of the United States Army and the Minnesota National Guard. I didn't know what I had done. But it wasn't the path that I wanted to travel down. And so I had to wait, I think it was like 5 months before I could go off to basic training. Because at that time in our country, it wasn't long after 9/11. You weren't going to enlist and ship off to basic training in a week. You were going to enlist and then you had to wait your turn. And so there was a lot of people joining at the time. And I can't even say that 9/11 had like sparked this sense of service in me either. I was simply at a spot where I was stuck. And while I was waiting to go to basic training, I had to start going to my 1 weekend a month drills. So I showed up there and I was in civilian clothes. Of course, I didn't have a uniform yet. I didn't know anything. I didn't know anybody. I had no idea what the hell I was doing. I didn't know if I even wanted to be there. And by the end of that first weekend, I think it was weapons qual weekend. And so we went up to Camp Ripley, in northern Minnesota. And I rode the bus with the rest of the unit and met a bunch of people. And did a bunch of cool stuff. They even let me go up on the line and shoot a rifle with guidance, of course, with a babysitter, which was 1,000% necessary at that point in my life. When I went home after that first drill, I realized that I think I might like this. And after the next couple months, well, shit, this is going to be sweet. And by the time I went to basic training, I was all in. It was then when I got to basic training the first day that I had my, oh, shit moment. Oh, boy. What in God's name did I do? When the drill sergeants come on the bus and they start yelling at you and carrying on and this and that. Well, that's when it got real. So I went all the way around the block to just go across the street to say that not everybody has this initial call to service. Some people find that calling after they join, and once they've dipped a toe in, some people, they got to just jump in both feet. And there are some people that they dip their toe in, they dive in, they jump in, they wallow in it, and they just don't like it. It's not their thing. And maybe that's okay too. As long as you know it and you get out or put yourself in a spot where you're not going to get in anybody's way and affect progress. But when he says transformational, when Mr. Driscoll said that the military was transformational, well, I can relate to that. Because there were many things in my military career that were transformational in my life. But the first one was before I even stepped on a plane before I even put on a uniform that said United States Army over my heart, before I ever touched any black boot polish to shine any boots, or ever had my first bullshit meal in the chow hall, I had a transformational moment. So already, I can relate to the new Secretary of the Army, even just a little bit, which is way more than I can say about anybody who's been there before. I could say that I have a whole lot more in common as a United States Army infantryman, a trigger puller, with Pete Hegseth, the Secretary of Defense, than I did Lloyd Austin. I mean, Pete Hegseth is from around here. Him and I played softball against each other many years ago. I don't remember him being very friendly, but again, we were on different teams, and they were very competitive, if I remember right. I think they whooped our ass, to be honest with you. Maybe not, but I have more in common with him than I do any of his predecessors. I have more in common with Daniel Driscoll, the new Secretary of the Army, than I have with any of his predecessors. So if I was a guy who was still putting on a United States Army uniform, I feel good about the people that are in these positions. And that's refreshing for soldiers, because it's been a long time, and I can never remember, in all the years I served in a uniform, I can never remember a politician saying, nope, we are going to focus on the warfighter. We are going to focus on soldiers, their health, their well-being, their readiness, and then we're also going to focus on their families. The other thing Daniel Driscoll said in his hearing was that the National Guard, they need more assistance. The strain on their families when they deploy is astronomical. The stress on spouses and kids and civilian jobs are astronomical, and they need more support when these National Guard units have this insane operational tempo. He said it with his own mouth. Instantly, I can relate to that, because I live that. My son lived that. More than once, for more than one deployment, my son lived that. My ex-wife lived that. Not that I care about that anymore, but she did. She had to. Some extra support would have been nice, especially for my boy. It affects him. It did. I think it still does. So I instantly can relate. I love that. Anyway, we got to take a break. We'll be right back. Don't go away. Hey folks, real quick before we get back to the show. It's no secret that we have been experiencing a loss of sponsorships. Sponsors have been leaving the network, or the network leaving sponsors, due to our convictions. And so we have recently began to ask you, the viewer, for help. We need your help. You are the most important thing when it comes to this network. You are the lifeblood of the Stu Peters Network. And so we are asking for your help once again. And in doing so, the way that you can help is to go down below on this video. Right here, you'll see the red button that's titled Stu Crew. You see it blinking there. You can click on there, and it'll take you to the Stu Peters Network Locals page. You can sign up for a membership. It is $90 for 1 year, or $9 a month. If you do the $90, you'll get 2 months for free. Also, when you go to checkout, if you use keyword Stu Crew 1, You'll get the first month for a dollar. so these things are extremely important. Keeping the network funded and bringing you content and information that you're not going to find on the mainstream media. The truth bombs that you're not going to get from the mainstream media. This is where you get them. The new age of information is not the mainstream media. It is platforms like this one. And we bend over backwards and break our backs to try to find you the content and the topics that are going to really affect you. So for $9 a month, you can join the Stew Crew, get exclusive access to behind the scenes footage, all kinds of extra content that'll be available to you. Also monthly giveaways. This month, Curable, which is a local CBD company, has a huge basket of body creams and lotions and bath bombs and Epsom salts and booty scrub. Not quite sure what that is, but it sounds interesting. They are going to give this basket away to one Stew Crew member. So if you join the Stew Crew, or if you are a person that just wants to give a one-time donation, that's great. We will accept that too, and you will also be entered into a drawing. So get on over to the Stew Peters Locals page. You can also go to stewpeters.com and sign up there as well. But it is easier to just go down and hit the red button there that says Stew Crew and sign up that way. Again, it's $9 a month or $90 a year. You get two months for free. And when you check out, if you use Stew Crew 1 as a keyword, you should get 1 month for free. We really do appreciate your support. And as I said, you are the lifeblood of this network. We can't do this work without you. We can't continue to bring you all of this amazing content without your support. So thank you once again for being here. Thank you for joining us. Thank you for supporting us. We really do appreciate it. We really do love you. Thank you. Hey folks, welcome back here. let's continue. Before we went on the break, I was talking about how easily it is for me to relate to people like Daniel Driscoll, even to people like Pete Hegseth. And I think that it's important to recognize that for soldiers, for the people that are going to be under the charge of these men. I mean, and keep in mind that these guys are in charge of men at the highest level, right? So they're in charge of the whole shooting match. Pete Hegseth, of course, in charge of a lot more than just the Army. But Daniel Driscoll, for example, is the Secretary of the Army. So as it pertains to where the Army is, what they're doing, where they're going, equipment they're being fielded, how much ammo they have in storage and this and that, equipment, all those things, those are all under his guidance, all under his purview. But I think that a really important thing to remember is that when we don't have buy-in from the soldiers, a lot of that other stuff, although still important, doesn't matter as much. The men and women that wear the uniform, they're the catalyst for the success. Of course, they need the right tools, the right equipment, and the support to carry out the mission. They got to have that, or it's not going to be successful. I think we all know that. But having the bodies, the people in place that are committed to the mission, that are committed to the goal for the right reasons, makes our fighting force even that much better. Because when you have let's say a BCT, a Brigade Combat Team, it's about 3,500 soldiers. When you have a brigade size element and you got buy-in from majority, if not all of that brigade, and you send them on a mission to destroy an enemy with extreme prejudice and do it with all the tools of war that they have at their disposal, and let them use the full capabilities of all of those tools. And the people that are pulling the triggers, that are pressing the buttons, that are operating the equipment, that are driving the vehicles, are all committed and they've bought into the plan. There isn't a military on this planet that'll beat us. The problem is that we don't have that. And so we didn't get through the article because my soapbox was pretty tall today. But one of the things that I wanted to outline before we get on to the next thing involving the recruiting was the numbers. I want to talk about the numbers. And then we'll get to the video, the testimony to the Senate that matches up with this article. But the article says this: Army officials met their recruiting goal of 55,000 new enlistees in fiscal year 2024 after bringing in fewer than 51,000 recruits each of the previous 2 years. But Daniel Driscoll downplayed the success after meeting that mark. Downplayed the success of meeting that mark, saying he believes the recruiting target was picked because it was an achievable goal and not the number needed to properly staff the service. He promised to review future recruiting goals and end strength needs. In background material provided the committee ahead of the hearing, he also suggested a review of the Army's recruiting strategy to ensure it effectively conveys a strong value proposition to young people across America. So here we are again, another person being drilled by the Senate, and he is also talking about values. American values, the American dream, in this instance, the Army Corps values. Honor, duty, loyalty, personal courage, integrity, respect, all those things. All value-based. And why? Because those are the people that are going to buy into the mission. The people that believe that a strong military equates to a safe homeland. I seem to think that's a good idea. But let's talk about these numbers. In 2024, 55,000 new enlistees into the United States Army. 2 years prior, we fell short of 51,000. Now, what is the reason for that? I don't know. That is yet to be determined. If you ask me, I think a lot of it has to do with the idea that people believed that Donald Trump was going to win the election and they were going to join the service then. I don't know of any other incentive that people may have seen. Could it be that they saw that the country was at a breaking point? And they thought, oh, shit, well, we need soldiers, so I better go and enlist. Doesn't seem plausible to me. But who knows? Who knows what the real reason is? But I believe a value-based system could be helpful. But let's take a look at it's about a minute maybe. Of his testimony here to Senator Fisher of the Senate Armed Services Committee. Here we go.
Okay, recruiting. We see tremendous challenges with recruiting in the Army across all services. What is your current assessment right now of the Army's recruiting challenges, and how would you address them?
My sense is for the last 3 or 4 years, we have missed our goals. I believe even the goals we hit from the outside, it seems as if the Army lowered their goals. The best analogy that I heard is the Army threw the dart at the dartboard and then drew the bullseye around where the dart landed. That's not a great way to staff an Army. We have the fewest number of active duty soldiers that we have had since World War II right now. Conflict is erupting around the world. I think there is a story to tell of the United States Army that young people want to hear. And I think we have complicated that story a bit over the last couple of years. I actually don't think it is throwing more money at the problem. I think it's nice to get things like the GI Bill. I got to use the GI Bill, but I didn't enlist for that. I enlisted because I wanted to go serve my country. And I think young people stand by ready for us to tell that story again in a compelling way. And if confirmed, I look forward to working with you to tell that story.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay. Huge. Tell the effing story. Tell the story. That's what's missing. Folks, that's what's missing from this recruiting issue. I think he's absolutely right. Aside from shit that just makes sense, the story of America is missing. The story of America's military is missing. He had said somewhere else in his testimony that we're coming up on 250 years. Next year is a 250-year anniversary of our country and of the United States Army. I think that this could be a perfect opportunity for the United States government to tell the story of the United States Army and all it has done in 250 years. The sheer power of story, in my opinion, is magical. It may sound cliche, it may sound stupid, but it truly is magical. I mean, think about it. Our whole lives, we will pay money to go sit down, stuff our faces with popcorn and bonbons and Coke and whatever else they serve at the cinema to sit there and be engrossed in story as a way to escape. And I don't know, it hasn't been very many years, however many years, since people have been making documentaries and true stories, movies that are true stories. And millions and millions of people watch them. Oh, is this a true story? Oh, yeah, that's a true story. Oh, yeah, I'm gonna watch that one for sure. I've always wondered. The power of a story it does amazing things. And I think in this day and age, we've lost that because our society is so engrossed in these things, and computers and video games and TV and all this other shit that keeps us numb. It keeps us numb to what's going on around us. And of course, you got to sit in front of a TV to watch a true story or go to the movie theater, but there's just so many distractions. Sometimes I feel like people in this country are kind of just riding in a car And they're driving down the highway, and they're driving past all this amazing shit. This beautiful scenery, or like these modern marvels that are just out there to be seen. All kinds of cool stuff, even crazy stuff, you know, funny stuff, whatever. There's all kinds of stuff to see. But we're doing this. And we're looking at our phones. We're not paying attention to the world that's passing us by. And I think that's what he's getting at here. Put down our distractions. And let's spin a story. We don't need to spin a story. Let's tell a story of the United States Army and its 250 years. Maybe not all of the story is sunshines and rainbows. In fact, I'm sure it's not all sunshine and rainbows. But it's our story. Maybe the positive part of it is that after 250 years, we're still here. Are there places in this world that are older than us? Sure. But who gives a shit? We've been here for 250 years. A lot longer than many others. The question is, will the young people listen? Will they listen to the story? And I believe that if it's told right, that yeah, they will listen to the story. But I believe that telling the 250-year story of the United States Army isn't just an Army-produced story. It's not a government-produced story. If I was Daniel Driscoll and I was serious about telling the story of the United States Army, I would start getting the United States Army soldiers' stories and learn from soldiers, their trials, their tribulations, but also their successes, their high points, their triumphs. Because there's a lot of them. I think that you'll find a lot of stories of men and women who never thought in a million years they'd be able to accomplish things that they've accomplished while wearing that uniform. You'll hear from people that never thought that they could be a successful part of a team or even be on a successful team that have done some pretty cool things. You're also going to hear some stories from people who lost everybody. Whether it was in combat or to suicide or to an accident, health issues, who knows? But all of those micro stories, if you will, make up the Army story. The story of the United States Army isn't just the United States Army. It's the soldiers. It's the families. It's the stories of the places that we've been, the things that we've done, good, bad, and indifferent. But we need to recognize all of it. Pick out the things that are most worthy to tell. And maybe it's okay. Maybe it's okay to share a story or two about the things that we did, the United States Army, that weren't so great. Things that we learned from and did better the second time around. Maybe that's okay. But if we're talking about telling a story for recruitment purposes, you need to gather the stories of young soldiers. You need to gather the stories of old grisly veterans of as many eras as you can put a camera and a microphone in front of. Those are the stories that are going to get people to take a second look. When you can listen to a person talk about where they've come from, where they grew up, what their life was like, why they joined the military, what their service was like, and how it affects them now, then I think people will listen. But the most important part of any individual account of their service, whether they're still serving or prior, is, would you, in my opinion, is would you do it again? If you could rewind time and do it all over again, knowing what you know now, would you do it? And I think that you would find that a lot of people would say yes. Maybe I'm wrong, but I think a lot of people would say yes. I think that quite a few of those that say yes would have, I think they would say yes, but with conditions. I would say that I would 10,000% do it again. And my main motivation for saying yes, I would do it again, is because I wouldn't want to be where I'm at today and live out the rest of my days without the relationships that I have or had while I wore that uniform. Those are extremely important to me. The injuries, the ailments, feeling like shit, being in pain, not sleeping, all of those things that veterans go through. I think that most of us would love to give all of that back. In fact, I would say, I'd go on a limb and say there'd be a pretty large number of veterans that would prefer to not have the ailments and give back every dime of their disability payments that they count on to help them live and pay bills and things like that. They'd give all of that back if they could keep their relationships. I think those are the most important things to many people. But if somebody told me, you can go back, you can do it all again. Of course, you can take a different path with your career. But if you want to go back to your day of enlistment and do it all over again, the same or a different way, you can do that. I don't know, man. I'd want to know that all my guys, all my brothers, my sisters, are still going to be my brothers and sisters when I get to back to this day. And I think those are parts of the ways that we can get young people fired up to put on a uniform and to serve this country and do it with honor and integrity and be proud. The fact that we are putting leaders in place that have thought about the warfighter, that have thought about the soldier, that have thought about the families of the soldiers, I think that's a great step forward. There's a lot of work to do, but what an exciting step forward. Now, there's a lot of people that aren't going to agree with Daniel Driscoll or Pete Hegseth or even Donald Trump. Of course, there's going to be people that don't agree. But if you're a person in uniform or a person that used to wear a uniform, even if you don't like any of these people, I think that we can all agree that having leadership that is concerned about the betterment of the soldiers and their families is 1,000% an asset that we have not had that will make military life better for anybody who joins it. 10% pay raise, that's nice. Got to tell you, that's pretty cool. But that 10% pay raise is only helpful for so long, because we're still going to send soldiers to foreign lands to do whatever their job is there. And their families are still going to need support. Cars are going to break down, and wives or husbands or whoever aren't going to know exactly what to do, and they're going to need assistance, they're going to need support. And the person that they rely on for support and teamwork is gone. So who cares that I got a 10% pay raise? My wife needs help, and I'm 50,000 miles away. I can't help her. And that's a horrible feeling for a soldier. So, Mr. Daniel Driscoll, if you ever see this, I was very impressed by your confirmation hearing and the things that you had to say. I think you did an excellent job. I look forward to seeing what you do next. Please don't make me look like a dipshit, but I have confidence that you won't. Charge on, man. Charge on. All right, folks, that's all the time we have for this week. We will be back next week for sure, just like every other week for, let's see what this will be. Next week will be our 145th show in a row. So we will see you next week for 145. You guys have a great rest of your weekend. Take care of yourselves. Good night.
As Christians in a Christian country, we have a right to be, at minimum, agnostic about the leadership being all Jewishly occupied.
We literally should be at war with fucking Israel 100 times over, and instead we're just sending them money, and it's fucking craziness.
Look at the state of Israel, look at the state of Tel Aviv, and look at the state of Philadelphia. You tell me where this money's going. You tell me who's benefiting from this.
I am prepared to die in the battle fighting this monstrosity that would wish to enslave me and my family and steal away any rights to my property and to take away my God. Go fuck yourself. Will I submit to that?
And if you've got a foreign state, you've got dual citizens in your government, who do you think they're supporting?
God, right now, would you protect the nation of Israel and protect those of us, not just our church, but every church in the world and in this nation that's willing to put their neck on the line and say, we stand with them.
You can look at Trump's cabinet. You can look at Biden's cabinet. It's full of Jews.
Black friend in school. I have nothing against blacks. She has nothing against me. She understands where I'm coming from.
Excuse me, I'm a Jew, and I just like to say that, you know, in our Bible it says that you're like animals.
The Jews crucified our God.